I think we'll read three verses this morning, starting with 39, then 40, 41, Canto 3, Chapter 28, Kapila's Instructions on Devotional Service. Text 39, translation, because of great affection for family and wealth, one accepts a son and some money as his own. And due to affection for the material body, one thinks that it is his. But actually, as one can understand that his family and wealth are different from him, the liberated soul can understand that he and his body are not the same. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. The status of real knowledge is explained in this verse. There are many children, but we accept some children as our sons and daughters, because of our affection for them. Although we know very well that these children are different from us, similarly because of great affection for money, we accept some amount of wealth in the bank as ours. In the same way, we claim that the body is ours because of affection for it. I say that it is my body, and then extend that possessive concept and say, it is my hand, my leg, and further, it is my bank balance, my son, my daughter. But actually, I know that the son and the money are separate from me. It is the same with the body. I am separate from the body. I am separate from my body. It is a question of understanding, and the proper understanding is called pratibuddha, which is a word in the verse, most likely. No? Oh, for the previous verse. Pratibhuta vastu. Pratibhuta in the previous verse is awake. By obtaining knowledge and devotional service, or Krishna consciousness, one can become a liberated soul. Forty is connected, just extending the message of 39. So 40 reads, the blazing fire is different from the flames, from the sparks, and from the smoke, although all are intimately connected because they are born from the same blazing wood. Purport, although the blazing firewood, the sparks, the smoke, and the flame cannot stay apart because each of them is part and parcel of the fire, still they are different from one another. A less intelligent person accepts the smoke as fire, although fire and smoke are completely different. The heat and light of the fire are separate, although one cannot differentiate fire from heat and light. Text 41, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is known as Param Brahma, is the seer. He is different from the jiva soul, or individual living entity, who is combined with the senses, the five elements, and consciousness. Report, a clear conception of the complete whole is given herewith. The living entity is different from the material elements, and the supreme living entity, the personality of Godhead, who is the creator of the material elements, is also different from the individual living entity. This philosophy is propounded by Lord Chaitanya as Achintya Bheda Bheda Tattva, Everything is simultaneously one with and different from everything else. The cosmic manifestation created by the Supreme Lord, by His material energy, is simultaneously different from and non-different from Him. The material energy is non-different from the Supreme Lord, but at the same time, because that energy is acting in a different way, it is different from Him. Similarly, the individual living entity is one with and different from the Supreme Lord. This simultaneously one and different philosophy is the perfect conclusion of the Bhagavat school, as confirmed here by Kapiladeva. Paragraph. Living entities are compared to the sparks of a fire. As stated in the previous verse, fire, flame, smoke, and firewood are combined together. Here the living entity, the material elements, and the Supreme Personality of Godhead are combined together. The exact position of the living entities is just like that of the sparks of a fire. They are part and parcel. The material energy is compared to the smoke. The fire is also part and parcel of the Supreme Lord. In the Vishnu Purana, it is said that whatever we can see or experience, either in the material or spiritual world, is an expansion of different energies of the Supreme Lord. As fire distributes its light and heat from one place, the Supreme Personality of Godhead distributes its different energies all over His creation. Paragraph. The four principles of the Vaishnava philosophic doctrine are Shuddha Advaita, parentheses, purified oneness. Dvaita Advaita, simultaneous oneness and difference. Vishishta Advaita and Dvaita. The four principles of Vaishnava philosophy are based on the thesis of Srimad Bhagavatam, explained in these two verses. Overall, just a little step back from what we just heard. The chapter is discussing Ashtanga Yoga mixed with Bhakti, leading to Shuddha Bhakti. So the previous section was detailing the steps, the each of the limbs of the Eightfold Process, concluding with samadhi. That's the number 8. Complete absorption of the mind in the Personality of Godhead, and leading up to that with all the previous stages successively coming to that position. Then we're hearing in these three verses, first of all, the consciousness of that person who is in that state of samadhi. Could you, someone find Bhagavad Gita? The consciousness of the person, they live here, they know where the Bhagavad Gitas are. The consciousness of the person in samadhi has a proper understanding of sambandhagyan. They know what's what, and they know Thank you. They know based upon realization. So when we find in Bhagavad Gita, of course, the message of Bhagavad Gita is Krishna speaking. So Krishna speaking about reality with a capital R, truth with a capital T. He's describing what is existential reality. The reader of Bhagavad Gita, initially at least, approaches it theoretically, notionally, conceptually. And, you know, some of the conceptions that are within Bhagavad Gita, they resonate with, you know, what feels right to us, and so we accept those things. There's some other things that may not so much resonate with us, and we may struggle with it a little bit. But in either case, and in between, it's still notional. It's not yet realized. This is describing the realization. Of course, so Bhagavad Gita is not just theory, it's what is. And Kapila is describing how the person who has realized what is, what that realization is. So there's this acknowledgement of being within matter, but at the same time a detachment from matter and the configuration of matter and the sensations of matter, the happiness and misery and the pleasure and the pain and the cold and the hot and the dualities of all the different varieties of duality in material nature. And it all stems from the proper conception of the Supreme. Because if you don't have a proper conception of the Supreme, you can't have a proper conception of self. And if you don't have a proper conception of self, then you're not going to have a proper conception of what's around you. What's immediately connected to you, like the body, and the objects of the senses that the body comes in contact with, and then what's even beyond what you don't come in contact with. You know, there's going to be a misconception. What's out there is potentially mine, if I'm an illusion, if I don't have a proper conception of the Supreme. So root in this process of devotional service, Kapila's instructions in devotional service, is applying the Ashtanga Yoga system to get to the point where the mind is absorbed in the Supreme, and then there's realization of the Supreme in ecstasy, a happiness that's unbounded, not anything like the happiness of indulging the senses and objects and thinking, I like, I don't like. It's a whole other... So then the realization is this consummate detachment while still functioning within that field. Just go back to Devahuti's question from chapter 27. This is 28, chapter 28. It's 5 or 6 verses long. It's Devahuti's doubt in response to Sankhya philosophy, where, paraphrasing, Devahuti says, well, what you say is correct. The living entity is in the category of matter and not in the category of spirit. Excuse me, the category of spirit, not in the category of matter. But they're inextricably connected. She reasons, what's the body without the soul present? And who can even think of the soul without a body? So while they're distinct, and you can feel some detachment by knowing, by knowledge, still spirit soul is in this sea of matter, and its implication in matter is the cause is going to create the result, the effect, again, unavoidably. So is it really possible to be extricated from matter? So he's continuing to answer that question. He answered it right away. He said, yes, by the power of bhakti, not by the power of knowledge alone, by the power of bhakti. Bhakti has its own power. And the bhakti power is such that it can dissolve that illusory connection. That's, you know, that's false ego, the soul misidentifying with matter. Because actually we have nothing to do with matter. We think we do. It certainly feels like it as well. Mind and, you know, our feelings, thinking, feeling, willing, and there we go. So his answer is bhakti has the power to dissolve that connection, the false ego connection, the mind connection, and still function. It's not like, poof, the whole thing goes. It's still there. But the identifying with it goes poof. And then one acts according to the indications of Scripture. There is this body, and there is this mind, and I have a psychophysical nature, and so I act according to my Daivi Varnashram for the service to the Supreme. And while doing that, that's like the social structure, and then within the social structure that's wholesome and nourishing to bhakti, I'm cultivating bhakti. That's the jewel. The whole purpose of the setting is the jewel that's, the setting is within. Cultivation of bhakti. And when bhakti is very mature, we're hearing what that soul, who's the realized samadhi capable follower of Kapila's teachings, what they realize. We discussed it a little bit yesterday, that nice verse from 11th canto of the Bhagavatam specifically. Just, they're totally distinct. And it's not just notional, it's realized. Just, I'm holding the Bhagavad Gita because Prabhupada writes like this in Bhagavad Gita. Chapter 2, text 41. Is the very beginning of Krishna's elaboration on Bodhi Yoga. The section before Bodhi Yoga. It ends in text 38. It begins on 39. Krishna says, I've described to you about Sankhya Yoga. Same as what Kapila is doing. Now I'm going to describe to you Bodhi Yoga. They're not like two different buckets, they're connected. But you know, one can bring one to the other. Exactly what's happening here in the Bhagavatam, that's why I'm paralleling it. And so Bodhi Yoga is analysis. It's the intellect discriminating between this and that. That's nice. Then what? Then fix the mind upon the Supreme Lord, Supersoul, within the Sankhya system. That's Satya Yoga. That's what you're supposed to do for perfection. So now supposing you do that. You discriminate. I belong over here. Now I'm meditating upon the Supersoul and all these ways that Kapila has described, leading right up to this verse. And then there's this absorption of the mind in Supersoul. One can not imagine, one can see with spiritual vision, not with material vision. You can't see with material vision, Supersoul. With spiritual vision, one can see. He's described what one sees. He described the ecstasy that one feels. And then what? So Buddhi Yoga. And at the beginning in Bhagavad Gita, the explanation of Buddhi Yoga, the break in the section of chapter 2 is text 39. And then text 40 is Swalpam Apyasya Dharmasya, that nice verse. In this endeavor, there's no loss or diminution. A little advancement on this path can protect one from the most dangerous type of fear. You know that verse. And then, so text 41, he's now expanding on what Buddhi Yoga is. 40 is like, get into it. It's, you know, the coach telling his team, go for it. It's a good program. Now here's the program. Vyavasayatmika buddhir ekeha kurunandana. Those who are on this path are resolute in purpose, and their aim is one, O beloved child of gurus. The intelligence of those who are irresolute is many branched. So this is where buddhi, where spiritual intelligence, is drawn upon and fully operated, operative, fully functioning. Spiritual intelligence. Come on in, sit on the mat over here. Spiritual intelligence, buddhi. Not the material intelligence kind, but the spiritual intelligence kind. One of my favorite purports of Bhagavad Gita, each sentence is like a book. It's really wonderful. If you ever have to give a class, you're not really sure what to speak on this verse. You're like, one sentence can take the whole class. It's really fantastic. Just meditate on each sentence. And they flow, but each sentence is volumes in itself. It's really nice. It describes faith, unflinching trust in something sublime. Anyway, when one is awake in Krishna consciousness, that's the stage that's being described here. Having done the Sankhya, having done the Ashtanga, now one is awake in Krishna consciousness. He need no longer endeavor for good results in his activities. Because your consciousness is right, everything else will follow. You don't endeavor for the result. You're not fruitive in your aspiration. You're devotional in your aspiration. And the results will follow. Because Krishna's in the front. When one is situated in Krishna consciousness, all activities, the body, the mind, the intelligence, words, all activities. Are on the absolute plane, for they are no longer subject to the dualities, like good and bad. Then, the highest perfection of Krishna consciousness is, going back to Godhead, right? Or developing love of God. Or, achieving Shuddha Bhakti, pure devotional service. Now what Prabhupada writes in 241, he writes, the highest perfection of Krishna consciousness is renunciation of the material conception of life. Because you can't get there if you can't get this right. Like that example, if you make a mathematical calculation wrong at the beginning, and you go on and on and on, more calculations, you do them all right, you're going to get the wrong answer. To get the right answer, you have to go back to where the mistake was. And then you correct the mistake, and then subsequently all the other procedures can be corrected, and you get the right answer. You can't get to love of God or go back to Godhead or Shuddha Bhakti if you hold on to the bodily conception of life. The highest perfection of Krishna consciousness is renunciation of the material conception of life. And then the last sentence of the paragraph is, this state, that's the highest perfection of Krishna consciousness, is automatically achieved by progressive Krishna consciousness. It's a little distracting, but a side note over here. I've been trying to secure, finally I got it just yesterday morning, from Borijan. He wrote a little essay, 7-page essay, in 2007 for the GBC. And the title of the essay is Our Automatic Process. 7 pages. Mainly it's like sutra-like statements supported by, embellished by some scriptural statements. So he draws from the scriptural statements and makes his own declarations. And basically, he's using the context of Prabhupada's using the word automatic. What does Prabhupada mean when he says automatic? It's not mechanical. It's not like a vending machine. It's devotional. But what does devotional automatic mean? It means if we follow the process. And where it's going is, while we may, as leaders, it's to the GBC, we may oversee and do and grow Krishna consciousness, spread Krishna consciousness, and by so we may wrongly think, this is his statement, that by doing that we'll go back to Godhead automatically. But that's not correct. There must be the nourishing of the creeper of bhakti by appropriate hearing and chanting and following the process of bhakti itself, and then the practical activities and combine them too, then you would go back to Godhead. We can't be effective leaders and go back to Godhead if we neglect that part of the process, the hearing and chanting carefully process. That's like summary of his message. So I'll go back. This state is automatically achieved by progressive Krishna consciousness. Both the renunciation of the material conception of life, because how many times have we heard about we're not this body? I mean, if we had a penny for every time we heard it, we'd be, wealthy. We've heard it many times, many times. But how much is there realization? How much do we act on that platform of consciousness? So it's repeated because it's important, and because, we don't exactly get it. So it needs to be repeated. And so this is Buddha Yoga. This is, after all the Sankhya is now completed, then comes the description of Buddha Yoga. And the last paragraph of the purport says the same thing. Well, all these wonderful descriptions of Buddha Yoga, last paragraph, the whole process, however, depends on perfect knowledge of the soul beyond the conception of the body. Dash. Not theoretically, but practically, comma, where there is no longer a chance for sense gratification manifested in fruitive activities, period. When it was not firmly fixed in mind, is diverted to various types of fruitive acts. So beautiful, what Prabhupada, how he writes what he writes. So Kapila is essentially saying the same thing, or naturally. Not like Kapila is saying what Prabhupada said, but Prabhupada is saying what Kapila says. What Bhagavatam says, what Krishna says. Now go back and read text 38. The liberated devotee, being awake to his constitutional position, you know, the soul's position in relation to the Supreme Soul, service, absorbed in service, mind fixed on me, on Krishna, and engaged in his service. Liberated soul, awake to his constitutional position and thus situated in samadhi, the highest perfectional stage of yoga, does not accept the byproducts of the material body as his own. That's the mind. So conception of God, conception of self, that's the I, and then comes the mind, because mind gets connected to the I. If I'm this body, then what's mine is the byproducts of the body, the fruits of my work, and then all the other things. It's so simple, at the same time it's deeply rooted in our consciousness. Like that question the other day about philosophy and psychology. You know, they're separate, but they're inseparable. Because how you conceive of yourself says a lot about what your condition of mind is, what your mentality is, your psychology. So which one do you adjust? You have to adjust your conception of self, and that will. But it's not like, well, that's automatically then going to take care of the mental, because the mental can get in the way and you can't even go there to what you know. You say, yes, I know, and you don't accept it because, you know, the mind is elsewhere. The mind wants to run around and be an enjoyer somehow. So they have to be in alignment. And how the alignment comes is when the connection with Super Soul is there. Then Super Soul gives spiritual intelligence. The intelligence directs the mind. The mind directs the senses. And off you go, back to Godhead. Progressively. Then the next two verses are taking that notion and then expanding it over in a slightly different arena, which connects back with Devahuti's question of the inextricable connection between soul and matter. Only Kapila Dev expands it. There's the soul and there's matter and there's super soul. Or as Prabhupada said, there's spirit and matter and the controller of both. So then there's categories of matter, different, subtle and gross for starters, the gross body and the subtle body. And then there's the soul, and then there's the supreme soul. So in one sense, they're all mixed up. Like Devahuti said, how do you extract them? They're all mixed up. And philosophically, well, they're all mixed up, but they're also different. Chintya Veda Abheda Tattva. And if the soul is going to get it right about, you know, what's what, you know, which categories of matter, what's mine, I and mine, and there has to be the proper conception of the Supreme. It's not going to happen otherwise. Not just a conception, the proper conception of the Supreme. And when that takes place, then one can understand what's what. Prabhupada's example is really simple. When it's dark of night, you can't see what's what. And when the sun rises, then you can see. The Vedic language is, they say pots and plates, like, you know, vastu, stuff, objects. So the distinctions, even the material intelligence to discriminate between, you know, your shoes and your hat or something. To properly activate even material intelligence, behind that there must be spiritual intelligence. And when spiritual intelligence is activated, then the material intelligence becomes useful. You can go to the kitchen and make a nice offering for Krishna. It takes some material intelligence to know how to, but the superlative manifestation of that intelligence is with devotion to Krishna behind it. And then it's super excellent. It's transcendental. So things that are material become spiritualized by the force of bhakti. And buddhi, spiritual intelligence. And then one can see this inconceivable thing of the simultaneous oneness and difference of all things. You can be in the body. I mean, this, I'm just simplifying what's being presented in the purport. You can be in the body and know, you know, this is my hand and not identify with it. And this is super soul and you identify with super soul, and the same super soul is in the heart of everyone. That's that universal brotherhood notion. It becomes more than like a notion. It becomes how you see and how you function. It's a whole different quality of life. It's not notional. Because notion, then a little pinch and you forget your notion. You go become an animal again. Defend and do all those other things. For the platform of bhakti is not created by circumstance or checked by circumstance. It's not material. When bhakti, Vasudevi Bhagavati Bhakti Yoga Prayojata Janiyati Ashu Vairagyam Yanam Chad Cha Yadahaitakam. So the knowledge and detachment arise causelessly, and it's causelessly. It's not circumstantial. Last thing is, it's a really long explanation, but I'll make a long explanation short. In short, the philosophy of Achintya-bheda-tattva is the justification or the philosophical basis for devotional service. So just say a little bit, but it's like it's a big subject. How can we justify calling this sacred? For example, what is it? Is it trees and cotton and pigments? And that's sacred. What's sacred about trees and pigments and cotton? Whatever else, probably a bunch of chemicals. to preserve the paper or something. It's in relation to the personality of Godhead. Where the New York Temple is, previously it was a synagogue, Temple Mount Sinai. And before that, it was a place where the Masons had their, they built it. Masons were, besides, you know, Masons, they built buildings, that was their trade. But there was kind of like a secret order. And they had like secret teachings. And they had, you know, like it was kind of spooky. The Masons sold the building to the Temple Mount Sinai folks. And the Temple Mount Sinai folks didn't change much, upstairs at least. They used what was, however the Masons used it, they used it for classrooms for children. So when we bought the building, we went in and, you know, had to figure out how to use those classrooms for ashrams. So one of the things that they had was like a podium, a platform for some, literally a wooden platform for someone to speak from, and one of those stanchions in front of it. So when we lifted the wooden platform, underneath there was a skeleton, human skeleton. It wasn't from the rabbis, it was from the Masons. I don't know how they used it. But it was some part of whatever their secret thing is. That was the Masons. And then, where those of you who have been to the Brooklyn Temple, the floor where there's offices, it's like, you know, from the ground floor, you walk up, and then there's this long corridor. Before it was a long corridor, it was the place where they kept the Torah. They had special ceremonies, and they're like, you know, it was really gorgeously decorated, opulently gorgeously decorated. And then towards the front, there was like a raised platform, and on top of the raised platform was this stanchion, and on top of the stanchion was the Torah. You know, they worship the Torah. It's sacred. Just as the Srimad Bhagavatam is tree and cotton and pigments and some chemicals. Sacred. What's sacred and go on, the Holy Bible and what is it? In the Sikh religion? What are they called?
Guru Granta.
It's sacred, you know, they don't have deities, they have the scripture, it's sacred. So what's sacred? It's the message within it. It's you know, from the divine and enshrining that which is from the divine. So it takes that which is material and makes it sacred. It spiritualizes that. And using that same principle, it applies to deity worship. And the same principle applies to, you know, musical instruments. You know, this word tadiya means paraphernalia used in the worship of the deity. It's sacred. Although it's like maybe a bell or a conch or something, just material. But you use that in service of the deity, you get the idea. So that which is, it's different and non-different. There's the connection. And when, so this is the, back to the point, the philosophical basis, how can we justify using something material, how can something material get you to a spiritual place? It's a good argument or a good question. And the answer is, because everything has its relationship with the Supreme. When it's used again in relationship with the Supreme, its spiritual quality is restored. One of the longest chapters, maybe it is the longest chapter in the whole of the Bhagavatam, is Canto 10, Chapter 87, Prayers by the Personified Vedas. And if you want to spin out, go read that chapter. We had our midterm GBC meeting in Tirupati, and they were reading from that section. Everyone, you know, class after class after class, it was like, get out your binoculars and try to follow what the speaker is saying. And, so the chapter begins, it's there's only 89 chapters in Canto 10, and this is chapter 87. So it's after Maharaj Pariksit has heard everything. I mean, all nine cantos and then all of Krishna's pastimes. And after hearing all of Krishna's pastimes, he's fixed in consciousness. And he says, at the beginning of chapter 87, I'm ready. Let that mystical snake bird come. My consciousness is fixed on the Supreme. And then he expresses a doubt. But I have a doubt. You know, how did this happen? Because you're using something material, your tongue, and I'm using something material, my ear. And how did I get something material? Something material equals something spiritual. How did it work? How did it happen? Shukadeva Goswami says, this is a very good question. It's such a good question. Long, long ago it was discussed. And when they were discussing it long ago, they said, oh, this is such a nice question. Long, long ago it was discussed. In other words, a classic question. And the discussion was between the personified Vedas and the four Kumaras on this topic. And the short of it is, it's long, but the short of it is, everything comes from the Supreme. It's a Chincha Veda Veda Tattva. Like, really expanded in high philosophy. Everything comes from the Supreme. So it has its connection with the Supreme. When you use the tongue and you use the ear in connection with service to the Supreme, the spiritual quality is restored, so it acts in a spiritual way and you get to a spiritual place by using something spiritual. It's because of Achintya Bheda Bheda Tattva that devotional service has its philosophical foundation and justification. So rather than being, I mean, we can be simple in heart and simply follow the process that's given to us, the process of devotional service. But in case you're asked, you know, what's the philosophical basis for using material things in service to Krishna? There it is. Chincha Veda Veda Tattva. Everything has its relationship with the Supreme. And connect that something in relation to the Supreme in devotion. That's the medium of connection, the link, the yoga system is bhakti. And it becomes fully spiritualized. Even in this material world. And same with the mind, same with the intelligence, same with your consciousness. And then one can distinguish there's this diversity while there's things are all packed up together. It's really nice. And he's still answering that nice question of Devahuti, the chapter and a half later. Okay, I'm going to end. Any questions? Yes. I'll send you the article. Uh-oh. It's your daughter?
question is, in the verse it's described about the affection, that because one has affection for the body or the extension of the body,
yeah,
the identification is there. And then I was connecting that with this automatic or progressive devotion service and people of our own devotion. The nurturing of hearing and chanting, I was feeling that if we just stay at the level of regulation, that's not enough.
That's right.
We need to cultivate affection for the process and then
yes.
actually for
yes, the that's right. But you have to begin somewhere. So we begin cultivating the quality of goodness which is characterized by regulation.
But then also beyond regulation, I was just trying to see that how the affection, like I was just relating experience also, like having a child and that
yeah.
flows. But it's like...
You don't have to cultivate it, it's just there. Well, yes and no. I mean, and the higher stage, it's natural. And the disease stage is, no, we have to cultivate it. But it's actually natural. It's actually natural. And that the natural is so powerful that once that natural starts to flow, everything comes in alignment. It's not like, oh, I don't care about my daughter anymore. She's nice, but, you know, I don't really care about her because I'm in bhakti now. That's not what happens. It's a different kind of caring in relation to Krishna caring. Anyway, we can describe it, but we don't know what it is until we enter into that kind of attachment for Krishna. Then it's another kind of attachment or affection. Step by step. But, you know, I'll send that article to you. It addresses how, in that article, but the simple is by the nurturing process of hearing and chanting, the watering process of hearing and chanting, the seed of bhakti grows. The seed of bhakti is the liking to serve Krishna. You know, even in like the most rudimentary of forms, like, you know, your daughter may see you doing arti and she wants to do arti. It may just be imitative. No, you know, like real, genuine, like mature. You know, but that's a seed. Children dancing, little children dancing. They see adults, even they have seen adults dancing. They start dancing. Anyway, it's a seed. Some people like to cook, so cooking is nice, and then cooking for Krishna is especially nice. That's the seed, is the desire to serve Krishna, proposing the constitutional position of the soul upon Krishna, indifferent according to one's nature. And that's the seed, and as that grows by the hearing, and so how to is the hearing and chanting as the core activity, and then the qualitative way in which one hears, and qualitative way in which one chants, that helps the seed of bhakti grow. So that's the natural process, like gardening. The seed grows. And as the seed grows and matures, then the affection for Krishna grows, and then the affection that one feels for one's children likewise becomes spiritualized, and that spiritualized affection for family members grows. It just changes. It's the transformation of affection to the spiritual plane. Okay? It's really wonderful. Without it, it's really sad. People that try, you know, to love without bhakti, you know, the at best there's a mode of goodness version, and that's rare. And more common is the mix of so many other things in the name of love. And then it becomes passion, then it becomes, you know, violent. Because that my expectations haven't been met. And so on. Anything else? Yes?
Maharaj, you were explaining about the seeing in relation to Krishna, Achintya Vida principle.
Yeah.
So usually the tendency of people is to kind of justify, you know, doing something wrong and saying, this is how I'm seeing it as a, this is for doing it for Krishna kind of thing. For example, if they...
Yeah, I've got an example.
So if they say, they're doing something bad, so they say that it's inspired by Krishna, so for me, this is how I'm getting inspired and Krishna is making me do this. Or in other words, vegetarianism and people having meat, they kind of justify it saying that, I see them in relation to God, but then God has given me this for eating. So this kind of,
I got it now. Yeah. Well, this question was asked at Krishna House by one of the attendees. And, the short answer is, okay, there's an inspiration realization. Now you hold it up to the light of Scripture. And, you know, does it match? Because that's the pramana, that's the evidence, or the means of knowing, is that notion or inspiration or realization or whatever it is, does it match what Scripture says? And you know, Guru Sadhu Shastra, that's our checked and balanced system. It doesn't work. That, you know, that the checks and balance system doesn't work when somebody is stubborn. I had one flight from New York to Chicago on Southwest Airlines. It was spring break or something like that, and a Cornell University student sat next to me, and I was a little surprised, because one of the nice things about dressing as a Hare Krishna devotee in Southwest Airlines is most people don't want to sit next to a Hare Krishna devotee. So they have, you know, select your own seat policy in Southwest, and I usually end up having nobody sitting next to me, unless the flight is packed. Because,
how they find out that you're going to sit there? How they find out that you're Hare Krishna?
Well, that's how they find out. So, you know, they don't want to sit next to a weirdo. They want to be next to a normal person. But some people are curious. So this college girl sat, and, you know, wanted to get into a conversation, so the whole flight was a conversation about, you know, Christianity and Krishna consciousness, you know, back and forth. So, you know, bright girl, Columbia University, bright girl, and, you know, politically correct in the sense of being, you know, not judgmental and being open and, like, you know, all that political correctness, and very bright. So, I thought it would be nice to explore what the path that Prabhupada did on vegetarianism. And long story short, she went through like 16 different passages, starting from the Old Testament and then into the New Testament, of, you know, why on the one hand, but on the other hand. You know, yes, there's some indications in the Old Testament that you should be vegetarian. But, you know, the bottom line for her was there was some passage in Matthew or something like the book of Matthew that said, well, you can't exclude people from the grace of Christ if they have some bad activity. Everyone is eligible for the grace of Christ, including eating. So I said, okay, we don't exclude people from the grace of Krishna, but a point that we agree on is a real Christian is one who wants to please Christ. And a real devotee of Krishna is one who wants to please Krishna. It's bhakti. We got it. We agree on that one. So supposing Christ is holding a lamb in his arms, and you'll walk up to Christ and say, can I have that lamb to eat? And you're not a destitute person, you're a college girl at Cornell University. And you ask Christ, can I have that lamb to eat? What's he going to say? And then he stands there and watches you chop the head of the lamb and rip out the insides and, you know, do the whole thing, and he's going to smile. So I said, just think about it. Because you may not be doing those chopping and pulling out and stuff, but somebody is, and you're eating, you're implicated. And think about what's pleasing to Christ. Whatever the book of Matthew says about you don't exclude people that may do like that, but you have options. You're a discriminating, bright young person. Consider what's pleasing to Christ. Think about it. And that's in, you know, where what Christ was and taught got edited out. Anyway, something else? Yeah.
You know, yesterday you said that due to the material laws of nature, there's variety. Otherwise,
yeah.
Religion would be one.
Otherwise?
Because otherwise, religion would be one. There wouldn't be variety.
Well, yeah. Okay.
But there's also variety outside of the modes of material nature.
What's that? But the essence is one. There's varieties of love, but the essence is love. I mean, let's just take a really obvious one that's in the news all the time. Jihadists. Their religion is destroy people. Is that what God teaches in the Quran? I mean, I've had conversations with Islamic people and, you know, scholars in Islamic religion and so forth. And in short, it's not there. It came later. And some people said, this means that, and let's do that. So it's influence is the influence of the mode of ignorance. Destroy and kill and da-da-da-da. But that's not the, you know, the essence. It's the modes of nature. Yeah?
Arj, wouldn't you say that this dispensation that Muhammad was giving to the people that he was with is of a different nature than that mercy given by Lord Chaitanya?
Of course. But, you know, the essence isn't different. He was addressing a specific audience. Yeah. Time, place, circumstance. But it's not. I mean, I don't know. I'm not a scholar of the Quran. I'm excusing for interrupting your question. But I'm not a scholar of the Quran, but I can't imagine that a messenger of God is going to say, go kill him.
Yeah, but, you know, if you do read the Quran, I have read enough of the Quran. You can get so far, if you have already the belief that God is promoting love amongst people, you can read so much of the Quran where you get to a point, because it is telling you, quoting angels, that you have to kill the infidels. And if you don't, then they will kill you. That is the conclusion drawn in many of the...
Well, two things. Lord Chaitanya said to Chankazi, there are so many mistakes. And Chankazi said, you're right. The scholars were imperfect. So what did Muhammad actually say? Who can say? And I, you know, so is the Quran an actual representation of what Muhammad taught? Prabhupada calls him Shaktivesh Avatar. Is a Shaktivesh Avatar going to say, kill the infidels? Now, point number two. In Bhagavad Gita, Krishna is inducing Arjuna to kill. So is there some correlation between those two? I would guess there is. You know, originally, initially, factually, it was recorded as something else. So minus Vyasadeva to record it and a disciplic succession to preserve it, we got what we got in the Quran. And who knows what renderings of Bhagavad Gita might there be out there.
Yeah. In fact, too, until Lord Chaitanya came, I mean, who had the understanding to know of this chanting of the holy name,
etc. And everything, all the other things.
Yeah.
I mean, there are, prior to Lord Chaitanya, the four sampradayas existed, and I trust that the four sampradayas were teaching the basic instructions of Krishna in a realistic way, not in a distorted jihadist type of way. Go kill people that aren't believing the way that Ramanujacharya said or Madhvacharya said. And I mean, come on, if that's the message of Bhagavad Gita, go kill them, chop them. That's what Krishna wants. Go get him.
But Christianity took that route as well.
Of course.
Romans,
yeah. That's the most of nature. We, the rulers, want to conquer and have more territory. And a very good way to do that, to justify it, is they're heathens and we'll bring the crusades and, make them religious. Chop them up and take their kingdom over in the name of religion. So we have more treasury for our kingdom and more power and this and that. It's just a perversion. And that, the priests went along with it because they got more power. It's awful. Really awful. And, the world, the history of the world is filled with awful things like that. Yes.
I mean, related to that question, if we in our Vedic civilization, if we have a reformer like descending every 100 years, approximately.
Have a what every 100 years?
I mean, a reformer.
Reformer.
Acharya. We have acharyas like coming to propagate the God consciousness. Similarly, why they are sticking to the same thing, which is.
Who's they?
The Islam, what they've invented 1400 years ago, even though that is wrong in certain areas and they have some misconceptions on that, why can't there be a reformation in that? Why Krishna cannot arrange that?
No, Krishna can do anything. The modes of nature are there. He doesn't interfere.
Because till date, it's almost like every time we are looking, okay, there could be some changes. It's aggravating, but it's not getting improved.
Well, I'm sorry I brought up the Islam topic. It really can go on and on and on and on and on and on. And on.
Especially like.
I understand the question. Let me respond. Let me ask you a question. Why do the modes of nature exist?
Why
do the modes of nature exist? You can say, well, Krishna created them. Why did Krishna create them? Why do the modes of nature exist?
Because
No idea, right? Well, living entities have minute free will. And they can properly use it. No, there's no modes of nature. No modes of nature. Improperly used, there's modes of nature. And mixed, they create all variety. Not only varieties of religion, all variety of everything. All variety. Mix them, match them. Which one do you want? Step right up. Modes of nature. So because of the living entity's misuse of free will and the modes of nature, there's stuff, including this one. And there's other ones, and there's all varieties of other ones, too. But some people want, that's the mode of nature they're inclined to. So Krishna does, he sends. And some people say no. Then he sends some more, and they say no. And it gets worse for those that keep saying no. And then finally he sends Kalki. He chops them up. Liberates them. No more bondage for their misuse of free will. Liberated. Pure. That's what he does. But he doesn't, you know, if free will means free will. Proper use and misuse. There's punishment for the misuse. But then he liberates them. Involuntarily just liberates them. Chops them up.
Could you clarify a little bit on their perspective of ahimsa? Christians.
Who is them?
Islam.
I'm not a scholar in Islam.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Well, I mean, we can see by their actions that they don't hold any form of ahimsa.
I don't know. I can't say. I can't say. I can't say what they have.
You can see with Christianity, when Christ came, he gave them a different, I call it a dispensation of God's mercy, you might say, and that he was commanding people to love one another.
Yeah.
And that even if someone treats you like an enemy, you don't treat them in any regard. With the same
form. Right. Yeah. Now, I the role in Vedic teaching, the role of Varnashram is very clear. The role of the Kshatriya to give protection is very clear. The Kshatriya must, according to Dharma, give protection and not, you know, use their strength otherwise. I can't think of a place in the Bible where it teaches like that, but there must be. Render unto Caesar what is Caesar's, render unto God what is God's. You know, so acknowledging those that are in a ruler position, they must, from time to time, in appropriate circumstances, take measure. A protection, which is not there in Buddhism, but it, you know, there and must be. So I can't think of an example. We're really floating around here in this question-answer session. Yeah.
Well, actually, last time you came, there was a session on endeavor and desire, and you spoke, you know, in favor of both. I mean, ever since I've been meditating on that. What is your conclusion? So there should be an endeavor also.
What is the conclusion about which?
For anything to happen, your desire is enough, or there should be an endeavor also?
The endeavor also. Again, this is this question of automatically. I'll try to do it simple. Respond in a simple manner. Good qualities become the decoration of the devotee. One need not make separate endeavor. So that seems to be on the side of you don't endeavor, you just be a nice devotee, and, you know, falls from the sky comes good qualities somehow, mystically. There's another, I'll send to you the same article. It doesn't specifically address this, but it leads to it. It points to it. There's 26 qualities of a devotee. And one of them is Sarup Lakshana, the other 25 are Tatastha Lakshana. The Sarup Lakshana is Krishna Ekasharana. So take shelter of Krishna. So now I want that one, because that's the Sarup Lakshana, the principal characteristic. Now that grows, and I become a little matured in taking shelter of Krishna, wishing to please Krishna. I wish to please Krishna. That's grown in my life. Now, what will be pleasing to Krishna? And I read chapter 12 of Bhagavad Gita that says, this and this and this and this and this are very dear to me. That and that and that are very, very dear to me. That and that is very, very, very dear. So I got Krishna Ekasharana happening in my life, and I don't have that quality over there, not so much. So now what do? I cultivate that quality. Why? Krishna Ekasharana, it'll be pleasing to Krishna. Not separately. Not separately. I don't need to make an extraneous endeavor. It's connected to the bhakti endeavor, pleasing Krishna endeavor. So cultivation is required. And that's the automatically. It follows the bhakti. No separate endeavor required. It's a bhakti endeavor. That's my understanding. I think we're going to end. Srila Prabhupada ki
jai.
Jai.
Swami Maharaj.
Jai.